From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. The way we live with our weather is changing. Global warming means our seasons are becoming more unpredictable. A couple of decades ago, the writer L. Hunter Lovins suggested a more apt phrase would be global weirding. One of the ways we'll be experiencing weirder weather in Illinois and the Midwest is through flooding. Higher water, more often, and for longer periods of time. Americans, humans really, have tried many different approaches for living with and near rivers. For a long time, that's meant the proactive control of nature through dams and levees, and also the reactive attempt to redress harm through government programs like flood insurance. But if flooding keeps getting worse, will those efforts be enough? What if everything we're doing is only making the problem worse? And how do we find a sustainable path forward? Tim Palmer has been thinking about those questions for a long time. As a writer and photographer, he's produced more than 30 books on our environment, rivers, and conservation. His latest is called Seek Higher Ground, the Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. It's out next month from the University of California Press. Tim Palmer, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Brian. It's great to be with you. Thank you.
And listeners, Tim will be with us for about the next half hour or so. You can join our conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. Especially if flooding has affected your life, how has it? Do you think our attempts to deal with flooding are working? And what do you see as the forecast? How do you expect to see floods change in the years ahead? Again, 800-222-9455. All right, Tim, I want to begin with your own flooding story. You were living in central Pennsylvania. Hurricane Agnes strikes. This is 1972. You're at the epicenter of the storm. Take us back through what you experienced that day.
Yeah, so this was a remarkable event, Brian. One of the really formative events of my life and certainly my career. A big storm was coming. We knew that Hurricane Agnes had moved up the East Coast, but then it had drifted offshore into the Atlantic Ocean. Everyone sighed a big sigh of relief, but then it turned back into the United States and hovered around North Central Pennsylvania for 3 days. It just rained and rained and rained. And so I lived right on the floodplain. It turns out my house was not flooded, but it missed by only a very narrow margin. The high water came up within one step of the first floor elevation. Other neighbors suffered deeply. I ended up helping them. We shoveled mud in the aftermath. The roads were closed. This was a remote Appalachian village. But as soon as they opened, I returned to my job, which was the environmental planner for the county. And so at that point, it was my obligation not only to figure out how to recover from this flood, but how to avoid the damage in the future. And that led me on a long and very fascinating journey. And after my planning career, I continued that journey through a decades-long career in writing about rivers and river conservation and watching flood issues nationwide. And ultimately, that brought me to the book that you've mentioned here, which is just coming out. It's called Seek Higher Ground, the Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. And I'm thrilled to be here talking to you about it today.
Yeah, I want to stick with that event in 1972 for a moment, though. What did you think, like, is there something about flooding that you thought before it happened that you basically, you know, you had your sort of, what's the expression, like your illusions disabused, or I'm probably mangling that. You know what I mean? Like, what did you learn from that experience?
Yeah, you know, I grew up 200 miles from there in the Ohio River Valley downstream from Pittsburgh. And the flood of 1936 was central to the local lore of that area. You know, my parents talked about it. My grandparents talked about it. We knew that the flood was a really catastrophic event. And so floods were kind of evil. You know, they were a menace to be avoided. And they were a reason for the government to get deeply involved after the Flood Control Act of 1936, building dams, building levees. And We kind of thought that that would do the job. But then being in the middle of the biggest flood of the time, the Hurricane Agnes flood, showed me that everything we had done was really inadequate and in many cases counterproductive. We had spent billions building dams, trying to stop floods from occurring, to no avail. We had spent billions building levees to try to keep floods away from our houses and businesses, yet the floods would overtop the levees and destroy them in the case of Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania in 1972, where 100,000 people were suddenly flooded by a failed levee. And we had spent billions more in relief, trying to pay people just to alleviate some of the suffering after the floods occurred. So as a planner, and as a flood victim, and as a planner, then even more so, I realized that we had failed to do the thing that really makes the most sense, which is just stay away from the floods. 90% of our floodplain in America is not heavily developed, but could be. So critical on the to-do list is zoning to protect that open space so it is not developed, which will make the problem even way worse. And number two on that to-do list is help people relocate to get out of the hazard zone wherever they're willing to go.
Well, yeah. So, when did that change? Because, right, there we can go back to the Bible, the man who built his house upon the sand. When did we decide that building our houses on the floodplain was a worthwhile idea to pursue? Because it used to be people understood that that was not a great idea.
Well, I think that, there certainly were people like that, but the more dominant rule and modus in the past was to really not pay too much attention to it. The nation developed with a pioneering spirit that we could overcome any natural obstacles, and floods were one of those. Floodplains were the flat area easily developed when it wasn't flooding. And next to our watercourses, which were many of the big ones then, certainly in Illinois and in Pennsylvania where I lived at the time, many of our watercourses were navigation conduits with barges and riverboats and commerce. So there were all these reasons to build on the floodplain or at least near it. And people really didn't pay that much attention to the rules of nature. And, we didn't have science and engineering and hydrology then to actually warn us about what the chances of flooding were. So, the dominant theme here is one of careless development. And, a big part of the story of my book, the at least the chapters on history, are how we came to realize that floods are natural events. And there's actually another side to this coin. They're actually beneficial to the natural environment, and how we need to recognize that and to see the limitations of the way we had developed in the past and seek another path.
Well, and I want to come back to the idea that there are benefits to flooding. This reminds me of the way we now think of wildfires, right? It's something we tried to suppress for a long time, and now we're realizing that that was maybe not the greatest idea. But let's talk about, in from a modern perspective, what are some of the ways that we as a society try and stop flooding before it happens? Emphasis on try.
Sure. Well, historically, the big approach was to build levees. This goes back to the 1800s. Really picked up steam after a big flood in 1917 and a massive flood in 1927 in the lower Mississippi Valley. Building levees was actually the main strategy for avoiding flood damage. And in fact, the only real strategy of all groups, the Army Corps of Engineers. The Army Corps actually disagreed with building dams before 1936, thinking that they would be ineffective, that we had to just double down on building levees. So that was done with a vengeance. As I said, billions spent building thousands of miles of levees, 30,000 miles of major ones in the United States, many of those along the Mississippi and in the Mississippi Basin. And that did not do the job. And the 1927 flood showed government officials that fact. So then we kicked into gear building dams after the Flood Control Act of 36. The Army Corps built 400 major flood control dams on virtually every major river in the United States. But you know what? The flood still occurred. The flood damages kept going up regardless of everything we had done in those two categories of efforts to prevent flood damage. Damages kept increasing, the central reason being that we had no controls or even attitude about development in the floodplain. And so people kept building there more and more. And in fact, the levees and the dams contributed to more development because once those were built, people thought, oh, we're safe now. You know, the Army Corps built the dam, it'll never flood again. Well, guess what? It did. So the damages continued to increase. There were voices of clarity going back to the 30s saying, you know, we have to also consider land development as part of this equation. But they were drowned out by the enthusiasm for controlling nature and the reluctance to try to control our own habits and laws and regulations regarding where we build. So that movement to recognize floodplain management, as it came to be termed, as really an essential aspect of the solution here, is something that built momentum through the 60s and 70s and 80s and is still doing so. But we still have a long way to go, and that's why I wrote the book.
Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're speaking with the environmental writer and photographer Tim Palmer. He's got a book coming out next month called Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. You can join us today at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right, levees, dams, these are one government policy response to attempt to mitigate flooding. There is another layer, though, in terms of policy response, and that's flood insurance. Talk about, for people who are not familiar with this, who don't live in an area where they have to have it, how is flood insurance different from other types of insurance a property owner might purchase?
Well, it's the same, first of all, in that you kind of expect you might have a problem. So it makes sense to buy insurance to mitigate that problem when it occurs, just like fire insurance. It's different in that floods cause way more damage than fires. They're more widespread. They disable entire communities and entire river valleys. They disrupt whole economies, such as barging on the Mississippi River for like 6 months at a time. They're much more costly, and the insurance companies are well informed. So they know this. And that makes flood insurance a very poor model in their economic formula for making a profit. Thereby, insurance is too expensive for almost any kind of ordinary person to buy. So, seeing the limitations of what we had done, and knowing that the damage was continuing to get worse and worse and worse, public officials and a hydrologist named Gilbert White was one of the real pioneers in this through the 40s and 50s, clear up through the 70s, recognized that we should probably have a program of federally subsidized insurance. And a grand bargain was made, and here's what it was. The federal government would subsidize insurance for people, the poor, unfortunate people who already lived in a floodplain and really had few choices about where to go, subsidize insurance for them, provided that the local municipalities would zone the rest of the floodplain to minimize new development there, which would only make the problem worse. The grand strategy was, yes, we'll help people where they are, if the problem is not going to get any worse. And eventually, through relocation programs and people just getting sick and tired of being flooded and moving elsewhere, we'd eventually be done with the problem because by attrition, the floodplain development we had would tend to get phased out. Well,
so that was the plan. How did that work out for us?
Yeah. So this ended up being a great example of the law of unintended consequences. Number one, the actual regulations put into effect to prevent new development were way too weak. The development industries, banking, real estate, home building, all had a big role to play in this. They invested heavily in lobbying to make sure the regulations against future development were not too strict in their from their point of view. Meanwhile, the efforts to relocate people stalled out and really didn't get a whole lot of purchase. And so we've ended up with a situation where the flood insurance is indeed subsidized, which gives homeowners and future developers a backstop with the American taxpayer to cover losses when they do occur. So the people doing the development actually have less responsibility now for the damages that incur. So the program...
Misaligned incentives. Yeah. All right. We're going to have to take a break on the show here. When we come back, we will have more with Tim Palmer, whose forthcoming book is called Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. You can join us today. Do you live near one of Illinois' many rivers? How do you think about the attempts that we have made to deal with flooding? And what are you thinking about for the years ahead? 800-222-9455. More to come here on The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about river flooding, and specifically how we try to manage it, and the way those attempts might actually be doing more harm than good. We're talking about this with the environmental writer and photographer, Tim Palmer. He's got a book coming out next month about all of this. It's called Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. You can join the conversation today by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right, Tim, this is not so much a book about how flooding affects people as much as it is about how people affect flooding, which then comes back and affects people that much more. You make the case in the book, we talked about this a little earlier as well, that not only is flooding good, it's even necessary for our planet. Talk more about that, the difference it makes.
Yeah. Okay. So floods have been happening since essentially the beginning of time. They're the way nature works. It's called the hydrologic cycle. We've all heard of it. You know, the water evaporates over the ocean. It rains. It runs back to sea. Sometimes it runs back to sea in very large amounts. And there's nothing we can really do about that or that we should want to do about that because this is the way of the earth. And it turns out life for the millions and millions of years has evolved with those flood cycles. And so the health of rivers and all the life that depends on them and riparian or riverfront habitat is the richest form of habitat we have. The rivers and the life around them depend on periodic floods just for their own health and well-being. For example, the shape of a riverbed is governed by the high flows of floods. Floods form the riffles and rapids in mountain streams and the deep pools that are needed for cold water, while the riffles are needed for oxygenation and healthy water. Floods make all that possible. Floods are what spill out over the broad floodplains in the valleys and soak into the ground, restoring groundwater, which half our population depends upon for drinking water supplies. Floods are what flush sand and soil out to the ocean, and it's that sand that formed our beaches in places like Atlantic City and Southern California. And so if we stop that flow of those floods and the silt that they carry, the beaches begin to degrade as the ocean currents take sand away and there's nothing coming in to replace it. So if you like beaches, you gotta like floods. And if you like fish, you have to like floods because fish depend on floods for the habitat they need for spawning and breeding and rearing. If you like riparian habitat and ducks and geese and shady trees along our rivers, you gotta like floods because they're what nourish all that habitat. So floods are natural events. The natural ecosystem actually needs them. They're only 7% of America. We have other places to go for development. And so it just makes sense to recognize those forces of nature, to work in alignment with them instead of against it.
We had a text message from a listener from Anne in East Peoria who's curious about the massive draining of the prairie to create farm fields. How has that affected the ecosystem? The idea of taking away wetlands, concentrating water flows, pollution. Tim, I wonder if you have a perspective on that.
Yeah, it has definitely had an effect, as does everything we do to the landscape, really. You know, this now falls under the broad category of watershed management. What we do to the land affects the flow in our rivers. And what we have done way too often fails to recognize the way the natural water system works, and instead to try to subvert that by pushing the water off the land faster through drainage or through canals and flush it downstream quicker, which of course aggravates flood hazards downstream. Now, this doesn't mean that all drainage was a mistake by any means, or that all levees even have been a mistake. There are places, you know, where that's what we want to do, even considering everything in our society. But we've done way too much of it with way too little regard for the way rivers and natural systems actually work. And that, you know, that's the corrective factor that I really advocate for in my book.
All right. So one of the things we would need to do to implement some of the solutions, and we can talk about those, is convince people the idea that this is not a good place to live. Maybe they should consider relocation. Of course, we have to compensate them for that, too. But one of the ideas that people have is this idea of the 100-year flood. And you write in the book about how maybe that's not the best way to think of it, especially in an age where flooding is changing dramatically. Talk more about that.
Yeah. So once you begin to think about relocation or protecting floodplains, the first question is, well, where is the floodplain? How much land are we talking about? You know, where is it safe to develop and where is it not safe? So hydrologists and economists and planners make efforts to calculate what the flood frequency is going to be. When a 100-year flood means that there's a 1% chance of that particular area being flooded in any given year. And for a long time, that was regarded as kind of a safe standard. But as it turns out, we have very little data to base that estimate on. You know, sometimes only 50 years, rarely more than 100 years of flooding, which is a blink in the eyes in the cycles of nature. So we have very little data to base our mapping on, so it's no surprise that it would be incorrect at times. In light of the lack of data, you'd think that we would have a very high regard for the precautionary principle, which is that when you really don't know what you're doing, you should be cautious about it to eliminate error and slippage in your judgments. Unfortunately, that was not the case either, because as I mentioned, the development interests became involved in these mapping efforts, and it's in their interest to restrict development as little as possible. Turns out the 100-year flood is not enough because of the miscalculation I mentioned. And now the floods are actually getting way, way worse. So we're seeing 100-year floods occur frequently. And in the Mississippi Valley, we've seen 500-year floods repeated, you know, several times in a decade. Ellicott City, Maryland had a 500-year flood and a 2,000-year flood 2 years apart. So what's going on here? You know, the data is wrong. The floods are getting worse. We've not regarded this problem as seriously as we need to do.
What reaction do you get when you talk to everyday people about these ideas, especially people who live in these areas?
You know, the reaction, of course, varies, but there are a lot of people who recognize it's not good to live in floodplains. I mean, people who get flooded the most know this the best. And eventually they get really sick and tired of it, you know, buying all new appliances every 5 years or 10 years or even just once. They get sick of it. And if there is a good option for them, they are often eager to take it. I interviewed one amazing woman in Charlotte, North Carolina, Carol Thompson, whose family got flooded repeatedly. Her husband didn't want to move. Eventually, he passed away, and she was there left to make the choice and decided to get out. And she took advantage of Mecklenburg County's buyout offer, which was very generous. They gave her, excuse me, they gave her the pre-flood value of her property, which was much higher, of course, than its value after it flooded. She moved out. That really helped her. It didn't totally solve the problem, and it doesn't solve the problem of a lot of people, because buying a new house is still more expensive than staying in the house you've been in, even if you're dealing with flood hazards. And in the long run, it's not, but in the short run, it often is. And so relocation appeals to many of these people, you know, to answer your question, but there's still problems in implementing that strategy that we need to address.
You mentioned the idea of who lives in floodplains. What, talk about that in terms of, be it socioeconomic distinctions, class, race. I mean, who ends up living close to these rivers in these areas that are getting inundated more and more often?
Yes, I've found that there are essentially two classes of people there. One are those who live there because they always have. It's the most economic option for them, just giving their flow of money today. And they have very little choice on where to go. And of course, our minorities, people of color, are often at the center of these groups, but not always. You know, it's economically disadvantaged people of any race or culture. And a second group are those who love living near rivers, or even more so on the seacoast, because they love living there. They like the view to the water. They like the cool breeze during the hot days. They like to be able to go swimming or cast a line for fishing. You know, the waterfront acreage is extremely valuable for those reasons. So we have two very different classes of people here, those who really can't afford anything else and those who are so rich that they can afford it. And for both of those groups, however, and for the taxpayers and people, the rest of us, the best solution is to get away from the flood hazard wherever we can do that.
All right. So just about 5 minutes left in our time together. What is the way forward then? So, right, we talk on this program about different ways we might limit the effects of global warming, or at least learn to mitigate its impacts, learn to live with what we are going to be experiencing, it seems. How do we limit the effects of more intense flooding, both, I guess, on an individual level and as a society?
Yeah, well, let me start at the deepest level here, which is we need to begin to regard the laws of nature as laws that we need to follow, and to recognize our own laws and habits and customs as things that we can change whenever we have the collective will to do so. So that's the starting point. Specifically, what this means on flooding is that we now know that our reliance on dams, levees, and relief are not adequate. Floods are getting worse. Damages have always been growing worse. We need to take the common sense approach of protecting the 90% of floodplains that are still open space, to keep them as open space, and to help people relocate from that 7% of America that is prone to flooding and disasters, and move somewhere else on the other 93% that is not flood prone. And so that involves a reversal of the priorities as we've seen them. The Natural Resources Defense Council did an amazing study using thousands of data points and determined that for every $1.70 that we spend helping people move to be away from the problem and done with it, we spend $100 of taxpayer money helping people stay to get flooded again. And we do that through relief, through subsidized insurance, and other means. We need to reverse that formula so that the priority is on getting away from the problem rather than trying to reinforce our homes, to raise our houses, and ultimately just face the larger floods of the future anyway.
And how do you make that case to people who might be more resistant, right? This idea that they cannot go on, it's at their own peril. Do you cut them off from the insurance? How coercive does this have to be?
Well, I think coercive would be the wrong word. In terms of zoning, we need to recognize that open space, as it has always been, is what we need to sustain. And in terms of moving, we need programs to help people pay for the relocation. There are wonderful programs in effect. Nashville, Tennessee, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Charlotte, North Carolina, and many others, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, many of them, many Midwestern towns along the Mississippi have programs that help people to move, but we need to fund those better. And in terms of convincing people, you know, I'm a writer, so I try to think logically here. And an amazing thing about this story is that it draws on economics and engineering and ecology, but also on culture and on equity and on policy and politics. And all of it together, to me, made this story an amazing one. And so I try to engage people in that story to realize the depth and the breadth of it, to know that logically it makes sense to protect floodplains, to move away. And, you know, but ultimately it comes down to an emotional decision. And for many people, simply getting flooded over and over again is what's necessary before they decide that, yes, it's time to throw in the towel and get on with a better life in some other location nearby. So convincing people is a matter, you know, it's a mix of all these approaches and all these attempts that we might have to seek a better society, really.
Tim Palmer is the author of Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. It's out next month from the University of California Press. Tim, great to speak with you. Thank you for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you so much, Brian. It was my pleasure.
Coming up, we are going to be talking with somebody who is attempting to bring the idea of pole fitness into the mainstream. That's coming up after a short break. I do want to mention, in less than a month now, Southern Illinois is going to be in the path of a total solar eclipse. We are going to be talking about it on the program. We'd love to hear from you. Are you planning to watch the eclipse? Where are you planning to go see it? And what parts of the experience are you looking forward to? Also, if you experienced the last eclipse some years ago in Southern Illinois, let us know what that was like. You can leave us a voicemail anytime, day or night. 217-300-2121 is the number. 217-300-2121. More to come here on the 21st Show after a short break. Stay with us.